You need to be able to control the video game. So how would you do that? Well, like, you got levers and like twisty knobs, so we'll just do that.
It's sort of like a Bop It, you know, in the early days.
Yeah. And I think it wasn't until, frankly, until the Xbox, when the people making controllers were like, hey, what about hands? What are those?
Yeah, what if hands what are used those, to do this?
What are those shaped like?
Butterscotch
Shenanigans. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 298 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm in the past.
I'm Sam, and I'm wearing red.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is February 12, 2021. Dunk on everyone. Before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be profanity in this show. We'd also like to thank our recurring supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. They went over there and then we grabbed their money. So thanks a lot for that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about life.
Mm-hmm.
Sam, you had a thing you wanted to talk about with gesture drawings.
Yeah, I read a book, and not just any book, importantly.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, a while ago I talked about this, I believe, this book called, or this rather, a collection of handouts, basically, that I had gotten as a PDF online that was just kind of floating around called Gesture Drawing for Animation. It's by this animator named Walt Stanchfield, and it's essentially a collection of
Stanchfield.
Mm-hmm. And it's a collection of all of these handouts from his teachings while he was working at Disney and some of these other, you know, fancy hoity-toity places.
Wait, so this guy worked at Disney and his name's also Walt?
I know, right? So it's one of those, you know, you hire people like you sort of things, probably, you know.
It's an in-group.
Mm-hmm. And so all the Walts over there, this is sort of the handout collection from there. And I just got to say, for anybody who is studying art or trying to get better at it or just interested in getting started, I think this was the book for me that kind of kicked it off, where he finally talked about it in a way that seemed like it made sense what you're actually trying to do. And it's just absolutely phenomenal. So there's now a collected, like, paperback bound thing that someone put together that's like all of the what was previously just these PDF handouts that were floating around online, you know, into a nice bound form. So you can find it on Amazon, and I would highly, highly recommend it.
Now, you said a while back, I remember you talking about this in the studio, that like he had made these little handouts and just kind of like gave them out periodically, like daily or a few times a week or something. Mm-hmm. Then you said that you had tried to just read through the book in like one go, but it doesn't really work that way because it's kind of meant to be like nuggets that you just like have a snack once a day, digest it for the day, and then read the next handout the
next day. Yeah, right? It's definitely one of those books that you want to kind of like, I guess, you know, poke around with the concept yourself. Before kind of moving on to the next one. And it's sort of like, it's just like so much condensed knowledge. And then the dude's just kind of like a goofy, fun, lighthearted teacher, you know? And so it's got a very different vibe from a lot of the other art materials that I've tried to pour over in the past that were far more focused on the technical side of things. And his is very much about sort of, you know, about what it means to make to do these drawings and to do animate and all this stuff and how to think about it, which is always what I had been looking forward to. How do you think while you're doing this weird activity, as opposed to just like what are you trying to do with the shapes specifically? So
one of my favorite things about animation is the name of it, because
to come to life,
it means to bring something to life, right? It's not about just like making it move.
Mm-hmm.
It's right. About you becoming Dr. Frankenstein.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You just inject some soul into stuff. And I think it's, you know, we're using Spine with Crashlands too. And a lot of Spine projects, I feel like, and just a lot of game projects in general, and even some of ours in the past have suffered from this idea that you're animating something when all you're really doing is making it move, if that makes sense.
You're not bringing it to life. You're just making its arms move.
Yep. Which, this is especially egregious with Spine because it's like it's just so easy.
Yeah, because you can just make things kind of like
Squish, just wiggling,
drift a little bit. Yeah,
yeah.
It still reminds me of my biggest pet peeve, which I probably mentioned before on the podcast. I imagine my biggest pet peeve in all of video games is characters and creatures that don't blink.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
you know, I think I also mentioned this once before. There was a game to play that everybody apparently loved. It was really well rated. Some little indie game. That I was so angry about the absence of blinking that I couldn't play it. it was just because I couldn't stop noticing. I couldn't stop noticing how lifeless and soulless the characters and creatures in the game were, just because of that one feature, you know?
Yeah. Well, this pulls us right into, I want to talk about Crashlands 2, how things are going. Because last week we talked about how after the global game jam, we had realized, hey, we've deviated too far from our core process, which is rapid iteration, polishing as we go, and focusing on sort of like the here and now, but working towards a vision, right? And one of the things that we've talked about being a core part of the vision for Crashlands 2 is making the world feel more alive.
Mm-hmm. Like really, really wanted to make it into a place, you know, mm-hmm. far more so than the original.
Yeah. And previously, because we had been trying to adhere to this grand plan, a lot of what we had been doing so far in Crashlands 2 is sort of filling out the world with essentially concept art. So we'd have lots and lots of things in the world, but none of which were actually finished or animated or usable in any kind of important way. They were just there, right? And so this past week, we've really put our focus into just a couple of things. So we've got these really cool sort of succulent-like plants called popwoods. Mm-hmm. They're like a big, tall, fat-based plant thing that have this big red flower at the top. But they're alive, and they like move around a little bit. And then they occasionally like suck the flower into the body. And then sometimes whip the flower back out.
It's kind of like what you see with those weird sea feather things, you know, where they like pull it back in and then kind of creep it back out.
Yeah, kind of because what we want with Crashlands 2 is we want it to be the case that like when you come in, it's clearly Crashlands, but it's also like definitely Crashlands 2. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so having this sort of like fairly common resource that's out in the world. Which we're basically kind of thinking about it as comparable to like the log tree of the original Crashlands. The log tree was a completely static image. It didn't make any sounds, didn't move, didn't do it. It just was there, right? And so having these popwood trees that like are making sound and they're kind of like wiggling a little bit and they're just doing stuff. And I think also we put an emphasis on audio this week. So we've got a bunch of new great sound effects. Fat Bard has made tons of cool stuff. And the fact that you can like walk into a forest of popwood trees and suddenly there's like this sort of like rhythmic cacophony of hearing them like crunching into their shells and like blasting their flowers out and stuff. It's like
– it actually feels like you're in a different place than you were when you were there, right?
Which is – yeah.
Yeah. It really came to life.
It did. And we were like, okay, yeah, this is the right track. Working on some new creatures, which I don't want to say too much about because I kind of want
it to be a bit. I don't think you can visually describe what's happening, to be honest with you. It's
you can. So there's no way you could ruin the surprise with mm-hmm. wordly descriptions.
Okay. I'll say what it is. So this first creature that we're working on is basically it's supposed to be the Wompit of Crashlands 2. It's like the more herbivore-like creature that's pretty common.
First creature you see.
Yeah. Not super aggressive. You know, it's just kind of like doing its thing. Kind of a grazer, right? So at the moment, we're calling this thing the Slugabun. I think that name will stick because it's pretty dope.
Mm-hmm. It looks similar to, I think, in one of the Ballyhoo newsletters. Mm-hmm. Sam put in some concept art that I think showed like two variants of the thing that was actually the precursor to what it is now.
I think that was the concept art that had all 10 of them in there.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah, number three was the one that we had decided to go with. I believe it was number three in there. And it was also the one that, I mean, conveniently, it's one of those nice things where it's like we more or less already decided to go with the kind of the rough body plan of number three. And then I looked at the feedback because people, you know, we asked people to respond, like, which one do you like the best? And actually that was the one that people were most keen on. But then we took it and sort of, I just did a bit more.
It's gotten weirder. Yep.
Yeah.
It's gotten a lot weirder, a lot more colorful and cool. I would say it's like if you combined a sea slug with a manatee.
That's about right.
And kind of, and maybe a bug. Mm-hmm. And then like put it on land and made it graze like a cow. And what I love about this
creature. I'm sure you all, everybody listening is picturing exactly.
Everybody's what like, yes, yeah, I see where, yep.
I know what that is.
So we spent a lot of time this week talking through like how to give this thing just a real attitude, like a real personality, you know, because it's kind of derpy. It's kind of dumb. It's just walking around eating popwoods, right? Which they do. They walk around and they gnaw on the popwoods. But the way that it locomotes, the way it moves around is it like tucks its body in to form a ball and then it squishes its head down into its body, kind of like as if it's like a beanbag chair.
If you've seen the video of a manatee like at an aquarium, you know, where you have like the underground glass thing you can look through, you know, there's a hilarious video of a manatee that's just like just sailing like towards its glass, right?
I think it's a seal.
Or is it a seal, maybe? It's some big blubbery creature, right? Yeah. And it runs into it, and then just its whole body, it's like the fat part of its body, because it's mostly fat, right? Just like, like telescopes in onto like the front of its body. So
it's basically, it gets perfectly flat. And there's just this like seal face kind of like in a flat plate of blubber, right? Which is kind of what I was going for with it. So,
So we wanted the slugabunts to feel like kind of like a squishy ball, boneless body thing. And so they squish their head into their body while looking skyward. Then they sort of slinky out really hard to launch themselves into the air. While in the air, their body kind of snaps back in into a ball shape, right? And then they drift back to the ground and kind of splat on the ground. And then they kind of reform and then tuck in and do it again. It's just like – and we don't have any audio yet for the slugabuns because we're still refining the visuals, but – we also have like ambient soundscapes. I mean, it's just all of a sudden this week, it feels like you load into the world. And even though now we've only got a couple of things in there that we've actually are like approaching a more finished state. Even with that, it's just like, it's really feeling like.
And the funny thing is there's only, I don't know, there's, what is it? There's so we got one animated creature. There's another creature or two that just float around because they only have one, you know.
They're just a picture that's moving around.
Yeah. So we've got one animated creature. We've got like the popwoods. There's like, you know, some rocks and sticks and things. So collectively, there's not that much stuff in there, but it already, in terms of like diversity of stuff, right? It feels, to me anyway, just like looking at it, it feels way more diverse than like the entire savanna of Crashlands, right?
Yeah.
And like into like the difference between like when you land in this game versus when you land in original Crashlands, like it's gonna feel so fucking different. Like you're gonna feel like you're in like a jungle with like wildlife and you know like it's very cool. It's gonna have a completely different vibe.
Yep. So I also want to say for a long time, all you're going to be getting about Crashlands 2 is snippets of us talking about it on the podcast, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Yep. We don't want to show anything until we are confident that it's not just going to be good, but it's going to just like blow people's socks off. So we're going to hold our cards close to the chest for as long as we can.
We want a proper reveal.
We want a real reveal. So that'll happen, but for now you'll just have to imagine these things. So very excited, great week so far. And now before we go to questions, we'll talk about a little industry, a little hot goss from the games industry.
Ooh, we'll keep it brief because there's not a lot to say. It's mostly just amazing, which is just a few days ago. So
First, I have to say this is part of our new segment, Stadia Watch.
Stadia Watch, yes. I guess a couple weeks ago or something, some people who were paying attention noticed that something appeared somewhere that implied that Terraria was coming to Stadia. So it wasn't officially announced yet, but they it had shown up in some material somewhere, just like how people discover games coming to Xbox because the achievements pages go live and that sort of thing. So I can't remember the details, but basically people discovered this and they're like, ooh, interesting. Like a game that people want is coming to Stadia. So this just happened. Okay. So then shortly after that, about 3 days ago, the creator of Terraria, I can't remember what his name is, something like Sphinx or something, tweeted out that this kind of long saga, which culminated in they were now pulling Terraria from Stadia and further would not be working with Google, the whole company, period, on any games moving forward.
So they're mad.
They're very mad. And it all stemmed from anyone familiar with like the YouTube stuff is also familiar with how angry people who make videos on YouTube are about the incomprehensible takedowns and things that constantly happen, because as part of Google's policy for dealing with this stuff, they provide basically no information and no recourse. So if they decide to pull your channel, they'll just tell you, hey, you're in violation of our policies. They don't tell you which one. They don't tell you what video. They just say you're in violation. And then if you get a few of those, or if they decide it's egregious enough, they just knock your channel down. But they could take it even further, sometimes do, where they basically disable permanently your entire Google account. So this happened to the creator of Terraria. And I'm not sure.
It's wasn't clear to me if it's it was the 505.
Yeah, it might actually
be YouTube channel.
I don't think it was 505.
I think it was Terraria's YouTube, because it was connected to his personal Gmail account that he started like 15 years ago.
Yep. You
know, right.
Before even Terraria was a thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, because 505 is actually a separate company. That's their publisher.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so Google basically sent them a note a while ago, like middle of January or something. They were like, hey, your YouTube channel is in violation. They made some thing about like, we don't think this was intentional, so blah, whatever. And then 3 days later, all of a sudden, just everything was down. It was gone. They've been unable to reach anybody to figure out what happened, unable to do anything about it. Just like everything is just gone. And since they haven't been able to resolve it.
Yeah, it's not just the YouTube account. It's all of the Google related. So this Gmail, all of his files in Drive, the YouTube account too. You think about like what would happen to you if you were just locked out of like your Gmail account, if you use that as your primary email provider?
For honestly, this got me thinking about that.
Yeah, me too.
You know, because it's like two-factor authentication, you know, Google Authenticator is like, or you use your Gmail for password recovery for other sites, or you just signed in with it, right? And it's like, if I couldn't get into that, I couldn't get into my bank account. I couldn't get into anything, you know? Because it's just at the center of all of it, and it's pretty unnerving.
Yeah, well, you know, just because you can buy domains through Google also, right? So, and you sign into that through your Google account. So, like, if you you couldn't even do a roundabout path where it's like, oh, let me just buy my own domain so that I can attach my Google email to it, so that if that falls apart, I can attach the same domain to a different email service. Still have I'm going to lose my emails, but I can at least the email address will still work. Like, no, because you wouldn't be able to get access to your domains to be able to go set your – so it's a nightmare scenario.
I think the problem is, like, what's option B?
Yeah, like, there's
no option B. Yeah.
Yeah, like, I don't know, set up a Yahoo account and tie, like, half of your online services to that. Yeah,
something. It really just shouldn't be the case. It really shouldn't be the case that an infraction on something like YouTube somehow implodes your email address.
Your entire life and business.
Yeah.
So this is essentially what this guy is.
So he was rightfully and righteously enraged by this situation. And he had one of those cards that the rest of us don't have, which was just so delightful, you know, because the card that he had was that Google owns this thing called Stadia that we talked about that nobody really wants, that they're really trying to sell and figure out how to sell. And one of the big problems is that they're having trouble getting games onto it that anybody wants, right? So here comes this game. Everybody fucking loves Terraria. It's a great game. This is also a really interesting – Terraria is an interesting case study for something that could go onto Stadia also. So it'll be really cool to see how that could work. It's in the works. It's all private. They haven't even announced it yet officially, right? And then they just like Google fucks with him. But he's like, I can fuck with you back, actually. That's a thing that I can do. And he does in the most spectacular way. So yeah, there's a lot of the karmic kind of, justice vibe going on with that.
It's kind of the Tim Sweeney vibe.
Yeah, it's a Tim Sweeney. Yeah, it's just like, it's in this, and it, but to me, it represented the, like my dream of what I want to have happen with our studio is for us to at some point have had enough success.
That you have leverage.
We have one of two things. One is either leverage or where we don't have to give a shit, right? Because
– well, they're kind of synonymous in a lot of –
exactly, right? Because it's not that he can use the fact that he's a Traeger developer to fix his email problem.
Apparently, which is shocking.
Apparently, which is exactly – which is crazy. But that's because Google, of course, compared to Terraria – is infinitely more powerful, right?
Right, because if Google doesn't get Terraria on Stadia, you know, they're going to – well, for starters, like, is anybody going to subscribe to Stadia because of Terraria? I don't know if it was even going to actually, like, help Stadia. But if on the scale that Google's trying to operate, you know, getting a really big-name game into a service like that, you know, could be worth millions, right?
Yep.
But, like, millions is literally 0% of Google's annual revenue.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you can't notice if millions go missing. Yep. So it just doesn't.
I mean, there was a story of that guy who was just billing them for millions of dollars for no reason, and they just paid him for no reason.
Just paid him. Yeah. Well, and this actually, so this is the thing that I've kind of come to learn. It's like, there are great, passionate people working at Google who love the stuff that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Google's mostly run by robots, though.
Yeah.
Like almost everything that the company does is robots doing it, right? So like this YouTube account got flagged by a robot. He got banned by a robot. He had to go through customer service run by robots.
Mm-hmm.
And at various points, he had mentioned like he actually had, you know, people at Google helping him and trying to get this resolved, but they lost. The robots beat them, right? Like there's all these systems in place that make these automated ban waves happen and stuff like that. And there's just not a person in there flipping the switch.
Well, there's also Google's also – their whole thing for a long time has been minimal customer service. So it is also the case that it is very, very hard just to get – either a robot or a person to help you do a thing if you get into trouble. I just found the whole thing very, I was just laughing when I read this article because So again, it's not a point of leverage. Like leverage is even better to have, right? But what he has as a person who like Terry has made, I don't know, probably $100 million or some ungodly number. Like it's made a lot of money. Right. And like they have a fair number of employees who the guy who owns the company has, you know, paid over the years and stuff, but still it's a small company. The fact is they don't need to be on anything. You know, they could stop selling the game period right now. And unless they're buying airplanes and stuff, then they'd still be financially fine for lifetimes. Right. So they're in that unique situation where they can just not put up with shit. Right.
Yeah.
And that's the next best thing to having leverage, right? And so my dream for us as a company is to hit that. That's what you call fuck you money, right? To hit that spot. I just thought it was delightful.
But you don't need to do stuff.
Also,
you
just horrifying.
You just are doing stuff, you know, yes. For fun.
Yep.
Very interesting. Of course, last week's Stadia Watch was about them shutting down their internal studios. So now they're shutting down external studios as well. So they're really expanding their reach. All right, well, let's get on to some questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. If you want to get your question onto a future episode, get on over there, slap it in the text box, and also go ahead and upvote some questions, you know, that you want to see get answered. So the highest voted question from this week is from Guigi.
Nice.
Which I think is Luigi's sort of slimy cousin. Do you guys drink coffee when you do your podcasts? I mean, yeah, I got mine right here.
It usually takes us so long to get the podcast started that I have finished my coffee. I always intend to.
That is one of the funny things about the remote side, because like the podcast used to be very slick from sort of, I would say like the starting to try to record it to the time it was done. There was maybe like 10 or 15 minutes in the pre-phase, mainly it was figuring out what we're going to talk about. And now there's, because there's technical shit, there's always like just technical errors. You're trying to get the sound right in your room. Every other time it's like, oh shit, we got a meeting running long for this or whatever else. And so it's been a different sort of a thing that makes the coffee kind of disappear by the time the podcast starts.
Well, this kind of makes me think of, I saw this YouTube video recently that was, it was a court hearing that had to happen over Zoom because, you know.
Is this one with a cat thing or is it something else?
Yeah. One of the, everybody on this call was clearly like, is very new to like using remote work stuff and video calls and whatnot. And
they all had gray hair and, you know, lots of wrinkles.
One of them comes in as a cat with a, like, he's got a filter on that puts a picture of like almost like a crying kitten.
That opens its mouth when you talk.
He talks. And he's talking, but he doesn't know that he looks like a kitten because he doesn't know how to use Zoom or anything, right? And so he's just like talking, and then one of the other lawyers keeps interrupting him. He's like, "I'm sorry, like you're you've got some kind of filter. I think there's a filter on. You're looking like a cat. You have a cat image." And then the guy's like, "Oh yeah," he's trying to get his assistant to help him out, and the whole time you could just hear him trying to explain that he isn't actually a cat. And they're all like, "Yeah, we know that." That's amazing. But that's kind of like, yeah, getting our podcast started every week. It's like,
yeah, someone shows up as a cat and you're like, oh, again.
Oh, there's a filter on. There's also always like programs keep trying to take control of our microphones.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yes. We can't use Google Hangouts to record the podcast because Google Hangouts just changes your microphone volume on the fly. Not just inside of itself. Right. And there are things you can supposedly do to prevent it from being able to do that, but
it always finds a way.
It always finds a way. It's pretty wild. So yeah, we actually have to use Discord because it's the only thing that doesn't do that.
But then Discord's been eating up increasing amounts of CPU for some fucking reason. So but I guess the coffee tends to be cold these days by the time we get to drink it, to be honest. But then also, you know, I made that matcha green tea cake like a year ago. And as part of that, I bought like a huge bag of that powdered matcha stuff, which is
real intense. Just powdered caffeine, pretty much.
Yeah. So I actually, as of the last week, I've basically switched over because I was like, I need to consume this somehow. And so at first I made one and I was like, I mean, it's just like drinking like grass. But the thing is, coffee is just as weird, you know, in terms of taste. Like, it's bitter.
You gotta get used to this different kind of weirdness.
Exactly. And so I've been ramping up my matcha intake these last couple of days. And I gotta say, starting the day with a green drink, it's real weird. And I'm like kind of into it. And I'm just loving it. So I think I might actually get on that
train. It's misleading because it's green, which you're like healthy, obviously, right? But I'm pretty sure that matcha like just buries coffee in terms of caffeine levels.
It's like, you do like a teaspoon and a half has like 45 milligrams caffeine in it. So it's like,
dude, I still remember when we went down to Uruguay and they had, what is it?
Yerba mate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That stuff.
Oof, socks right off.
Sam and I didn't know that we were drinking it like it was coffee, you know, and we like, before we put on a talk about publishing down there.
Yep.
We just went to a cafe, you know, using our semi-broken Spanish to order stuff. And we got the thing. And, like, nobody can explain to us how to drink it because we're not speaking good enough Spanish. Mm-hmm. So we're just slamming these things, like, for 2 hours. We're just talking. Like our conversation's getting more and more animated and engaged. And, like, by the time we get to give the talk, we're just, like, sweating and red. But, like, oh, man, just we delivered out a talk.
Yeah.
Like, we
– Yeah, right. The green grassy feel of these things, I actually prefer, because like coffee is, it's more of a, I don't even know how you'd say it. It's got a coffee flavor, obviously, but it's more of like a burnt or sort of it's roasted acidic flavor. Yeah, it's acidic versus that sort of just grassy sort of thing, which is definitely weird, but I actually like a lot. So I've been drinking matcha for the podcast instead of coffee. Long way to say that.
Matcha with Biscotcha was the new name of our. We're coming up on episode 300, so we got to do some rebranding. Right?
Matcha with Biscotcha. I thought you were saying with biscotti, and I was like, that would be disgusting. But
Matcha with Biscotti? No, no, don't do that. All right, next question comes from Dr. Hayes. Adam and Sam always get to be stuff, but Seth is always the games programmer.
That's true.
Yep. Seth, what else do you want to be?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. When I was very young, somebody said to me, hey, Seth, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, a giraffe. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't know that you could, that you couldn't do that. I mean, I had never seen giraffes be created. Mm-hmm. And I knew that people could become things when they grew up.
And you probably read Animorphs.
I read Animorphs. I just put two and two together. And I was like, somebody has to be becoming a giraffe when they grow up, right? Like, mm-hmm. Some people become doctors. Some people become, you know, engineers.
I mean, yeah, talk about that problem of self-rejection, right? Where it's like so many things, you're just like, you just decide not to do it because you're just like, I can't. There's no way. Right. But here you are as a child being like, the self-rejection is so far away from the idea that you could become a giraffe, mm-hmm. you know? And then just over time, we just lose that. And we start narrowing our vision more and more, at first to what's like actually possible, which is like, you know, a reasonable thing to limit it to. And then we start just limiting like even
physics
further.
And biology wise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then we start limiting even further though. And we're like, okay, well, sure. Like it's technically possible, you know? Right. But X, Y, Z, X, Y, you just have this list of reasons. And then over time, it just keeps on fucking, it just keeps getting narrower and narrower.
And then eventually you're just
a games programmer.
You're just a games programmer. And that's all you're ever going to be, mm-hmm. you know? So that's I know I'm kind of locked in now. I feel like that's just who I am, and I have to stay on that track because
live that games program.
My giraffe dreams were trounced.
I feel like it's a funny thing too, because it's like if you're if you as a kid just want to be an astronaut or something, I mean you're not dreaming big enough, to be honest. Because
yeah, people have been astronauts.
That's a thing that's possible.
Yeah.
But also, it's, you know, it's been done. You know, astronaut, that's yesterday's profession.
We've had those. It's an old – we've had those since the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about something new? You know, a giraffe. As far as we know, nobody's become a giraffe.
As far as we know. Not that you'd be able to tell afterwards, you know.
Yeah, or maybe every giraffe was, you know, once a person. All right. Next question comes from Jamie.games. It was kind of hard to read that without camel case, but I got through it. Mm-hmm. What was the best video game controller? So was in this question implies that
– it is no longer.
Was. So let's take a mental journey through the controllers of yore.
Are we counting like Game Boys and stuff since they have a controller, you know?
Yeah.
They don't have a controller.
Anything you can poke or move or – look at that causes a thing to change.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So I would say like OG Nintendo controller, the one that's shaped like a rectangle, real shit piece.
Yep.
But the SNES one that's rounder, that was pretty good. I like that one.
Pretty good. It was a step in the right direction because at the beginning, you know, you had like your Atari joystick with a button on it or you had like a Pong paddle, right? Mm-hmm. Because all they were thinking was like, you need to be able to control the video game. So how would you do that? Well, like you got levers and like twisty knobs, so we'll just do that.
It's sort of like a Bop It, you know, in the early days.
Yeah. And I think it wasn't until the Xbox when the people making controllers were like, hey, what about hands? What are those?
Yeah, what if hands what are used those, to do this?
What are those shaped like?
I will say
the Nintendo 64 was a step in the right direction,
and but was
the
fact that
it – It, like you could hold it in your hands like a person, but it had three fucking three handles on it. So it's like,
yeah,
what's going on with this?
The third handle is sort of weird. The whole concept is odd. I think
because you can only hold two of them at a time because you know you're a person.
Yeah, the big thing for me with the I remember the N64 controller, which I do think was one of the great ones.
It was good, yeah.
Was that one, was it reaching up to those, what they call them, the C buttons, which is essentially another D-pad on the right side. was basically impossible with small hands. Like, it was far enough up there that you had to, like, you had to take your hand off the thing and get up there and do stuff. And then that using that, I don't know what the fuck that joystick was made of, diamond, some sort of hard meteor material. But that thing would put a dent in your thumb if you played
it. Yeah, it would erode through your thumb like waves on a cliff face.
Yeah, you're just no good. Just day to day.
Until one day it pokes you right in the thumb bone.
Yeah.
Yep.
I remember I finished playing at a friend's house. I feel like I still have like a permanent dent in my left thumb from that thing. Like
I think that joystick also, it was hard plastic and it also took a bit more force to push around than modern joysticks, mm-hmm. you know? So you just kind of like put two and two together there and it's that's a recipe for thumb destruction.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also I genuinely can't remember a game where I ever put my hand on the left side of the Nintendo 64 controller. It was always the joystick. Yep. So you're always like holding it with your hands a little too close together, you know, but like they had the trigger, which was like a big thing. Like, oh, you have fingers. You also have fingers on your hand.
Oh, right? The Z, right. That was the one button on the back.
Yeah.
Right,
so like the big innovation that Nintendo had was they recognized that humans have hands and that they have shapes to them.
And they're fairly consistent. There are consistent. Fingers on those hands that when you're holding on to a thing end up in specific places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, that was a good innovation, but they didn't quite realize that humans only have two hands.
Only have two hands. And so it wasn't until many years later where the people at Microsoft were like, hands, two of them, fingers. I think we understand now.
Do you think the people who invented the Nintendo 64 controller were actually aliens?
Whoa.
And they just, there was a detail that none of them thought about, you know, like, so they're making this controller, they're using their three hands to, like, you know, use it, like, play games and stuff.
Yeah.
And so they designed it for, like, you know, for this three-handed thing, right? So they're doing all this stuff, and they've been trying to fit into humanity and stuff. They've been like, normally they're hiding their third arm, right? But in this context, just for some reason, just nobody thought about it. Just nobody raised that point.
You know? You just like
television. So they get this thing out, you know, and they're like, oh no, we just accidentally revealed our secret, and everybody just gets this thing. And they're like, how are you supposed to hold this? And that's the only question they ask.
It's actually the case that, like, what most people don't know about Nintendo is that actually aliens visit the Nintendo headquarters on a 12-year cycle and give them hardware ideas.
Yep.
Right? So, like,
because,
mm-hmm. like, every other generation of Nintendo is just a regular thing.
That's true. You know,
it's just like, yeah, a person could have thought of this. And then on a 12-year cycle, it's like, hey, what if we just like had two completely different controllers that were floating around in space and had like weird fucking buttons on them that were nothing alike each other? And also that has like a beam on the front of it that teleports shit onto your TV screen. Mm-hmm. What if we did that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then boom, now you've got Wii Bowling all of a sudden, right?
Yep.
So, and then, you know, later – you have the humans who were trying to like reverse engineer the alien tech, and they were like, people like two things. I don't know. Like, what if we like put a screen on the controller? Would people like that? And that didn't work.
Didn't pan out.
The aliens, so the aliens had to come back and bestow the Nintendo Switch upon us. But next generation, we're going to be back into human territory.
I'm genuinely like really interested in what the heck they're going to do for this next round. I mean, it's like
the Switch was too, for Nintendo. The Switch was way too like, here's a really practical, smart way of playing video games.
Yeah,
like,
but
just regular video games, not weird ones that require new things, but just
That's why they got that ring thing and the cardboard. Don't forget that. They still do their weird shit. You know what I mean?
I'll say though, with the Switch, the thing that bums me out about the Switch is that Nintendo, I think. What they really wanted to do was they wanted to merge their handheld and their console user base, right? Because they've been the Game Boy people and the, well, I guess, random weirdly shaped consoles people for a long time. And they wanted to merge them together. The problem is those have very divergent price points.
Yeah.
So instead they made the Switch at like 200 – was it $299?
I think so.
Or $199.
I think that's $300, I think. Pretty sure.
It's like – it's on the lower end of price for consoles.
But it's the same price as a 3DS.
Yeah. So it would be very easy for somebody who's like traditionally playing with Nintendo handhelds to jump over to the Switch, and also be very easy for somebody who was planning on buying a more expensive Nintendo console to instead buy the Switch because it's cheaper. Mm-hmm. The problem is, to make it cheaper, you got to use a lot worse hardware,
yeah.
Right? So we're starting to see now quite a few developers coming out who have been trying to get their games more optimized on the Switch. Pillars of Eternity just had an announcement this week where they're like, we've been spending years with a dedicated team just trying to get the game to run better on the Switch, and we're just out of options. Like it is what it is now, right? Yeah. So if you've been playing it on the Switch and you've been having performance problems, which you have been, if you've been playing it on the Switch, that's your life now.
It is a very weak piece of hardware. It is like we've been doing optimization experiments with Crashlands 2 to see like how the different spine things impact frame rates and stuff, and basically every device just blazing fast, doing just fine. Mobile devices, also doesn't matter. I get on the Switch, and the Switch is just like, I don't know about this.
Yeah.
Seems like a lot.
Yeah, it's like okay, yeah, sure, we've tested it on a mid-range 2016 Android phone, but have we tried it on a Switch? Because that's the true test. this is just a perennial problem with consoles in general, is just that they are supposed to be lower-priced things, right? I will say though, I was reading about PlayStation 5 and how it's actually being sold at a loss now, because Sony's thinking like, we just, you know, for the kinds of games we want to have on this thing, we can't get the hardware in at the price point that we want. Mm-hmm. So we're just going to sell the device at a loss and recoup the costs on selling the games. Mm-hmm. Right. Because Sony takes a cut through the Play Store.
Did they actually intend to have a higher price point? But since Xbox came out swinging with their... I mean, this happens every console cycle. It's the same deal. The two of them are coming out neck and neck, roughly the same hardware specs, right?
And then Nintendo's like, look at this!
Yeah, Nintendo does something weird. And then basically either Microsoft or Nintendo gets fucked because one of the two of them, while they have to compete with the same hardware and they have to compete at the same price, one of the two of them didn't make decisions that allow them to actually compete at that price, and they have to sell at a loss and hope that the game revenue can make up for it.
The Game Pass as a deal is just so stupidly powerful that I'm still just like, I mean, I get it. I get it if you want to play God of War or something like that, because I mean, I played it. It's fucking great. But good God, like just for the sheer value proposition of that, it's just too good.
Yeah. But there's the question of controllers, though.
Mm-hmm.
Xbox controllers
are really good.
I think Xbox controllers are just primo.
The PlayStation ones are fine. I don't know what it is about them. I haven't used the PS5 one, but it looks like it's the same fucking shape. It's just white.
Well, the thing is, the PS5 one has a bit more curves to it, right? Because like
it might sit in the hand better, but it's always been a bit too straight. Like, something about how you hold it doesn't 100% actually work with like how a hand works. And my guess is they're probably like shit because Xbox did like an ergonomic design for theirs, which like
patented to the
yeah. And all so that. Like they have to do a different shape, but it's like a really good shape for hands. So
I think Xbox nailed the right shape, and now others can't because part of the thing that of course they're differentiating themselves. And like it probably because there are knockoff Xbox controllers everywhere, right? So it's not illegal to make one, which means Sony could probably right. But that would be them admitting that.
You know, I want to see.
That would be them admitting. But hands have a certain shape.
Yeah, which you
know, I want to see a controller that is a sphere shape, or like kind of that you would hold like with your hands up.
I want two spheres so that you can just have your hands wherever the fuck you want. You can have them at your sides, just dangling, you know, and you can just be like pushing buttons.
So like the Switch situation, basically, but with like a nice gripped surface instead of like a weird thing that you have to cramp your hands around because they're
tiny. Yeah, because that's the thing is like Switch actually they because with the Wii and the Switch Nintendo. They made the brilliant move of being like, a controller doesn't have to be one thing. It could be two things. And that way your hands can be wherever you want them to be instead of like pulling them tightly together.
Incredible feeling of like playing a Switch and just laying there like with your arms flapped out.
Oh, yeah. Right. It's great, right? But like, there's no reason why an Xbox controller couldn't snap in half and just be two halves that you can hold at whatever dimensions.
Yeah. No, I would love to see that be like the usual thing.
Yeah, because the problem with the Nintendo controllers is that the Switch controllers are teeny tiny and they're not ergonomic.
Yeah, so they're uncomfortable despite the comfort of being able to split them in half.
Yeah. So like both, I would say if you get, if you brought both of those concepts together, ergonomically fit, but also break apartable, then now you're cooking with gas. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe the Xbox, what do we think the next generation of Xbox is going to be called? The Xbox.
We got the Xbox One and the Xbox Series.
No, we got the Xbox the Xbox, then 360, yeah, then the series.
Yep. I think Series is meant to be the last one.
I can't really find a pattern here.
But it's Series X and Series S.
I thought the idea that this, when they hit this generation, I thought the plan was to say, we want to treat this more like the PC kind of market, where you just have like things just get now better, right? But there's not like a major release where we claim that everything is new and different or whatever, but we just continue to put out new ones, you know, every couple of years or whatever, with just like higher specs. I don't know if that's true, but that was what I thought they were talking about.
That's what they've mentioned publicly. My guess is that their bet is on the long range, that all the tech developments that need to be happening are actually on the cloud side of things.
Really. Yeah. They are investing heavily in that.
Yeah, I think they've stated that they think this is going to be the last console generation.
I don't think so, because something that's been bugging me about all this talk about streaming games, okay, is the fact that streaming games effectively requires a high-speed internet connection, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you got to do it. But the reason you need a high-speed internet connection is because of the level of graphical fidelity of games. They have a lot of pixels that need to be streamed, right? They have a lot of hardware requirements. And one thing that continues to be true is that games continue to get higher resolution, mm-hmm. and higher graphical fidelity. And if already –
which means you're going to require more and more bandwidth to be able
to – so like how is bandwidth ever going to suddenly catch up? Like what's going to make that happen? Because they're both progressing, mm-hmm. right? But it seems like bandwidth in the US is not progressing anywhere close to the speed.
Oh, yeah, garbage infrastructure.
Well, I think what I'm hoping is that, you know, if given the size of the games industry now and also all the companies who are in it who are trying to do the streaming stuff, where it's basically just everyone, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Sony, everyone's trying to figure this out, that will finally create enough of a pressured incentive for the US sort of overall telecom stuff, you know what I mean, to like – forcibly
it won't, because they get no benefit, right? Because the way the whole thing is set up, because it's not a utility, right, which means that the government isn't responsible for it, so it's still companies doing it, but they, because they're in this weird like middle ground space where they just like have to let whoever wants to use it, which was, that's what net neutrality is, right? Is being like, ooh, even though you're Netflix and like literally all of every single fucking ounce of our bandwidth is going to your company specifically, we can't charge you more, right? Mm-hmm. Which like we need those rules to have an open internet. So like
this sucks for them, but like that's how it is.
We're just in this idiotic middle ground because we refuse to turn internet into a utility, where we're like, ooh, it's still companies. Like it can't possibly make any financial sense to put the incentives in the right place. So we'll just let everybody be in a monopoly, and then that's going to work. That's the end of the story, right? Yeah. So that's we're just toast until we turn it into a utility, which. You know, we're America, so
there's been some small towns in the U.S. or even larger cities that have tried to develop their own publicly provided internet that is funded by local tax dollars. And most of the time, a telecom company will lobby the local lawmaking body to make it illegal for city governments to compete against mm-hmm. telecom companies.
And they do it successfully because we're in a corrupt
state. Yeah, I think the argument that they always put forth, which it's now, I think like we're running out of states where towns can provide internet to their citizens. I think there's only like single digit numbers of states left in the US where it's legal for a city to provide internet. And it's the argument is that governments have resources that companies don't have. So if a government enters the private sector in telecom, then suddenly the telecom company can no longer compete, and therefore it's a monopoly.
Right? Even though
it currently is a monopoly, yeah. And they don't compete at the moment. So anyways, it's pretty fucked. But anyways, the broader point is streaming in the United States. I don't have high hopes for it.
Mm-hmm. That's gonna be a piecemeal replacement over a long period of time, not a wholesale thing.
Yeah. All right. I think probably last question of the day comes from Bam182, who says, it was brought up in a recent podcast that it feels like now is the midlife crisis of the studio. Mm. If that's the case, what's the sexy new Ferrari? Is it 3D games? So this is in reference to a while back we talked about like, what does it mean to be in to be making games now for this long? So we're coming up on 10 years of the studio mm-hmm. existing. But
not 10 years of making, because the first like year and a half was random, not real progress towards the company doing stuff.
Well, the first 6 months, we were working in another company right. and all that. So we founded the studio in June of 2012, and we started making Tile Fight 2 in November mm-hmm. of 2012. So this November will be like 9 years of the studio actually operating in a full-time capacity. So, in that time, we've done a lot of things. We've published 6 games mm-hmm. ranging from large to tiny. We've done dozens and dozens and dozens of game jams. We've gotten, mobile game of the year with Crashlands. We've secured lots of interesting business deals. We've gotten to go to GDC. We've done a lot of things. We went to Nintendo HQ, got a tour from like the guy who designed the Game Boy mm-hmm. and got to talk to him. Like, that was cool. And there kind of reaches this point where you're running out of stuff to do, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Like, you're running out of next things to
which, of course, isn't a real problem, right? Because that means that things are going great. But it's what we talked about in that episode, though, which is your whole life goal is oriented towards obtaining stability, right? Obtaining safety, obtaining resources required for you to know that things are just going to be fine, right?
Yeah. But safety is uninspiring. And
it's not interesting.
And uninteresting, and it's tepid.
It's really interesting architectural idea, which is that whenever you see a company finish its like principal headquarters, so most recent example would be Apple in this case. Whenever they have like the final, like finally have this building that they made from scratch that's like supposed to be the thing to house them, it generally marks the start of the decline of the company.
Right. Because they've hit a
point where they can do that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so yeah, I think for us, I would say that what the midlife crisis looks like for the studio is more so along the lines of no longer being – I would say you have to go find those things that basically you're not good at, and you have to go push on those. I think it's part of basically one of the problems with being in that sort of that security mindset is that you'll spend more and more time just in the areas where you can do things most effectively, as opposed to trying to ask the questions about like what, like it is generally the case that this is all there is in the domain that you've been operating. But if you can sort of, turn to the side a bit and add something else on, then you have a whole nother, big area to go explore. And so I think on my side of things, it's been, my interest on the art side has been, perked up a lot in the last 2 years. So I certainly don't feel as if I'm in that sort of secure, I don't feel like I'm in a midlife crisis point where I'm trying to like throw things out the window, just for the sake of it. But I think it's more so about, I've identified that I want to get really good at the emotional design side of both the art and the games. We talk about this with the soundscape, like the fact that right now, if you pop into this essentially what is, an early stage prototype for Crashlands 2, like you can feel it and it feels real good to just like wander around in there. It's a whole different, we're operating in a different realm than we operated before already with this. So I think it's, for me, it's been pushing further in that direction as we've gotten more secure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's a framing aspect to this, which is, you can look at the stuff that we're doing now, say like with Crashlands 2, and you can look at it in two different ways. You could say, well, this is just like, we're doing the same stuff, but just like the next iteration of that, right? Or you could look at it as we're doing a bunch of new things, right? Mm-hmm. Like completely new approaches to making the games, thinking about them about it in new ways, developing totally new systems to make all these new ideas work, right? But it is an extension of what we've done before, no matter what. So I think it's very easy to slip into the mindset of thinking like, well, I mean, here we are, like we're just making another game.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, there's like a few things that we're doing different, but like we're just making another game and we're going to make another game and another game and another game. And
then we'll die.
And then we're going to die. And we're on rails now. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think the midlife crisis mindset comes in, is when you stop recognizing the novelty and fun and interesting aspects of the things that you're doing. Well, I feel like you're just stuck in a routine.
Yeah. Right? Well, it's also, once you get to that point of, if you're lucky enough to get to that point of, you know, stability and security, recognizing that what that's given you is slack, right? Yes. Because with stability and security, you do have room to try things that in a prior state would have been dangerous, right? Because now if something goes wrong, right, the distance you fall is a lot less because you've got your own safety net that you've created, right? It's sort of like it's like going from when you're like if you were fairly if you had a fairly easy kind of a childhood and stuff, and like you get into college, right? And like in college, it's just everything is fine. You have nothing to worry about, right? This is assuming you're in a privileged state to like not have to worry too much about finances and all that stuff. But just like at that point, it's just like people always tell you like, oh, you're in your 20s. This is the time to fail. This is the time to try things. This is the time to do whatever, right? Because mm-hmm. you got all this time to recover. And again, like that's true for a certain amount of privilege, but it is true for some people, right?
Yeah.
And then after a while, you start to get to that state where like now all of a sudden you have things that you're risking, right? Or if you didn't have that privilege in the first place, you already were, right? But there's like stuff. Well,
like
that
if you hit a point where sort of like once you're out of that state, there's a pretty good chance that like you're at the start of your career, you're trying to prove yourself,
yep.
You've got lots of loans that you're trying to pay down, you know, all these different things. And it's the case that failure at that point suddenly has got a real cost to it.
Yeah.
You know? Because you're gonna, you know, you might lose your job, you might be unable to pay those things down, get yourself into a bad spot or whatever. So, I don't know. It's there's definitely like a I don't want to say like cyclical, but there's like you kind of move through these different states at different points in your life, kind of depending on what's going on.
Yeah, well, I do think there are two kinds of midlife crises, right? I think one of them is that you're sort of perpetually stuck in this high stress spot where if things go wrong, you're toast, right?
And you don't have the bandwidth to pivot in a way that's satisfying.
Yeah,
so much
right, exactly. You don't have the chance to take risks. Yeah, you just have to like keep on doing what you're doing, and you don't have options. You don't have the ability to say, I'd rather do this. I'd rather go experiment with that. I'd rather go try this because you don't have the safety net.
Well, what you're doing is always urgent.
Yeah. Well, and then you don't have stability actually, right? It feels like you have stability because like you've got a job, you've got
but
whatever.
You're trapped.
But you're actually trapped. And I think that's one of the, I think that's the toxic cause of, you know, a midlife crisis. Right. And you know, it's easy to walk yourself into that path because of what our particular society has valued, which is people flaunting wealth. Right. So you buy your fancy car, you get your big house, you keep on spending more and more of your money. Right. And the outcome of that is that you have to keep working harder and you can't go try a new thing because if you do, you have this bridge period where you can't afford your mortgage and you can't afford, you know, and things just start to get really hard. So that's the bad one, right? The good one that we're in is the one where you actually have hit that stable point and now you ask the question, is this all there
now,
is? You know,
now what?
But it's different than the question, is this all there is when you're stressed and when things are really hard, right? So this is the better form of the midlife crisis.
I think it's more along the lines. It's less of is this all there is and more of what else could I become or what else could I do, right?
Well, that's the healthy follow-up to the first question.
Yeah, because now that
– This converts it from being a midlife crisis to being like, oh, here's just another growth point.
A midlife opportunity, right? Because now you've got the time to step back and say, okay, now that things aren't on fire anymore – I'm not in panic mode. I don't have to do things 100% of the time, right? Because things are more stable and I have more options of like where to put my energy, where to put my time, you know. So now you get to pursue some bigger, more interesting things. Or, you know, you just blow it all on some really expensive thing and now suddenly you're now things are on fire again and you're back in your comfort zone.
Yeah.
Well, you're trying to pay down that Lamborghini.
Yeah, right? I mean, I can see that, how like if it just feels like you're toast anyway, it doesn't feel like you're secure anyway, all this kind of stuff. I can feel how just like a constant growing sense that you should just burn it all down. Like I could absolutely see how that would be the response to it. You shouldn't though, because probably the people around you don't have that chance.
That's the thing about fire, right?
Yep.
It's not exactly a contained.
You can't contain it.
Thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you light yourself on fire, you're also lighting everybody else on fire who, you know, is related to you in some way. So unfortunately, you can't burn it all down. You still got to continue forward. But that's, yeah, it's about trying to tailor your life around what you actually want things to be like versus what everybody else has been telling you they're supposed to be like, which is not an easy thing, especially because a lot of times it's your own family members doing it to you and your friends.
You know, I have like a medium formed thought on this. So I'm just going to kind of like talk it out or whatever. So I think it's something that I think is true about all three of us. And you guys can kind of correct me if I'm off base, is I think we've all kind of over our lives come to recognize that having things doesn't really help you for the most part, mm-hmm. unless it's something that you are using, right? Like to achieve an end. Mm-hmm. So, it's the case that I think still like Adam and I drive a 2010 Ford Focus.
Mine's a 2009.
2009 Ford. Adam's car is a 2009 Ford Focus with a stick shift. It doesn't have cruise control. Nope. It has like window cranks.
I've driven to Texas. I've driven to Texas and back without cruise control with a manual.
That's, yeah, and the thing is like, adventure. By now that car probably was. It's probably got like 80, 90,000 miles on it.
No, it actually only has like 50.
Oh damn!
Yeah, I have another 10 years on this car. Probably. I'm gonna keep on going.
Yeah, and the thing is like, it's a car. Sam wasn't even using his Ford, his 2010 Ford Focus in a pandemic, and he's like, "Well, don't need this anymore," and just got rid of it.
Yep.
Did he turn around and buy a, you know, a Tesla or some shit? No, no. He just doesn't have the Focus now. Yep.
If I need a car at some point, I'll definitely get an electric one. But you know.
But why would you get an electric one? It's because of the practical and ethical implications of it, not because. And also, you wouldn't get a like $80,000 car and put yourself into a bad financial spot, right? Yeah, and so there's a certain attitude that people can develop around stuff, around like wealth, or around like having high end goods, or trying to show the world that you have things, mm-hmm. you know. And I think chasing that outward display of status is such a big problem for people. Like it puts people into such a terrible spot so often. So this idea of like, having a midlife crisis, and like the trope, you know, is like you have a midlife crisis and then you do go and you be like buy something super flashy and expensive and extravagant that like is definitely going to put a huge dent in your bank account, or like, putting on like having a wedding that's like $30,000 or something.
My wife and I were just talking about this recently because it came up in some conversation. I can't remember, but like it was probably a pandemic related thing, but it just reminded me how fucking angry I am about the wedding industry, because its whole thing, if you boil it down, is hey, young couple, starting your lives together. You know, you could, like, there's a bunch of money, right, that you're supposed to somehow have. Right, which is of course not true for most people, but you're supposed to have it. If you don't, your wedding is ruined. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is now all this money, right, is you're gonna look at more money than you've ever thought about spending your entire life so far, which hasn't been long. Sure,
because you're right? Like 23,
because you're a baby. Right?
Yeah.
So there's all this money now. Yeah, sure, you could use that to get your financial life as a married couple started off on the right foot. Down payment on a house, paying off your debts, whatever, right? But no.
Nope.
Instead, every year, the price of having a wedding is going to go up, just like college, right? Except unlike college, which at least supposedly is going to help you for your future, right? You're just going to blow this money. It's just gone, right? And it's going to be tens of thousands of dollars. You know how much money you need for a down payment on a house? Tens of thousands of dollars, right? You know how much money you need to pay off huge chunks of your student loans? Tens of thousands of dollars. So yep. Take all that money and just fucking throw it away. That's what you're going to do, right? And like, I get it. Yeah, we're celebrating all this kind of stuff, right? But why does the celebration have to be coupled with spending infinite money?
Yeah, well, I mean, yep. Context is king for all this, right? It's more so about the fact that it's an industry that continuously has pushed people who don't have the means.
Which is almost everybody.
Yeah, which is almost everybody, to feel like you have to participate as if you have a certain amount of
because, means. Yeah, because a modern American wedding is modeled after what wealthy people do, like super wealthy people do for weddings, right? Mm-hmm. It's like it's part of this like American dream of like chasing being wealthy kind of a thing, right? Where it's like you if you don't have that thing.
American thing. Like it's
no,
it's
probably
always,
not. But
yeah, people, there's always the emulation of sort of you know, rich folks basically, like every culture does this, right?
But yeah, it just makes me so, because it is so hard to start off life, your independent financial life once you leave your parents, right? Nobody's taught you how to handle your finances. You're probably
and then you've got everybody, you know, potentially like people in your family saying that you mm-hmm. need to do this, right? Like you need, you know, and they'll even come in and be like, yeah, well, like maybe we'll spot, you know, a quarter of it or something like that, right?
Which that makes like, me even more angry, right? Because now it's like if you're lucky enough that your families have means, right, then there's a really good chance that what they're going to do is offer to pay for big chunks of the wedding, which is great. Mm-hmm. The question
is – that's the Jevons paradox, because now you're just going to have a way more expensive wedding.
Right, yeah. Well, it's not just that. It's that why is that the offer versus being like, oh, hey, let's – to help you set your lives off on the right foot – we're going to pay down a bunch of your debts or give you, right? Like it's.
Well, the reason that offer isn't there is because there's always just also going to be the wedding, and they've only got enough money for one thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to be.
There's a finite amount of money, which means it's going to go to
something.
I don't give a shit how people spend them. I'm going to be honest. Like I don't 100% agree with kind of the angle of the conversation, because like, if you want to spend money on a wedding, like, you do your thing. If you want to buy a Tesla, you do your thing. But if you're spending money that you don't have.
No, that's my point.
That's like where it all
gets. I also don't care how you spend your money.
Yeah,
the point is that for the vast, vast, vast majority of people, because most people are not wealthy people.
But it's just a bad – it's just a bad idea.
It's a terrible idea to have the first thing that you do as an independent financial taxable entity, which is what a married couple is, right? The first thing that you do is you suddenly either take money that you have or that you've – just recently gained access to via other people, right? And the first thing you do with it when you need
delete
that
it.
Money, because almost everybody does, is you just delete it, right? Because almost – yeah, and like sure, if you're a rich person, fuck, whatever. Spend your money – I don't care. Doesn't matter, right? Spend your money on anything, anyway. I don't care. It's up to you, right? But the problem with the wedding industry is it creates a societal requirement that instead of setting yourself up for financial success for the long term, you fuck the
beginning. You trap yourself.
You trap yourself immediately.
Yeah.
And put yourself into a financial situation that is makes it more likely that you're going to have financial trouble, that's going to lead to marital conflict, that you're going to have a midlife crisis 10 years later because you stuck yourself onto a treadmill because you threw tens of thousands of dollars away.
It was a beautiful wedding.
Way to kick it off, you know? Because you know, it would be like you say, like, "Hey, listen, I want to have like just a dope party, just a dope ass party. It's going to be like $30,000 though." Mm-hmm. And everybody would be like, "Whoa, that's a lot." And then if you were like, "Well, hold on, we're going to get the government involved though, and there's going to be a contract mm-hmm. signing." Mm-hmm. So and then people are like, "Oh yeah, okay, that makes sense now." Yeah. anyways, I don't know. I have a lot of. I think. People sometimes misplace value, you know, on like.
Well, same with that. It's about, well, that's certainly true, right? But like, yeah, a beautiful wedding that's expensive, that's great if you can do it. That's amazing. That's an absolutely fabulous thing to be able to do.
The context is king here for all this.
Yeah, context matters.
If it's not going to put you into a bad spot.
Yeah. But the fact is that it puts almost everybody into a bad spot, statistically speaking.
Yeah. And the thing is, and I will just to clarify, like, I didn't do it because I knew that I didn't have the means. My wife and I, you know, we've talked about, like, now that we're 10 years in, we were actually planning on doing for our 10-year anniversary.
Yeah, we were also
doing something like that, not nearly as big as probably like what a lot of people would do for a wedding. Still something pretty small, but like saying, now that we've established ourselves and we've been together for 10 years, now it's time to have a party. Mm-hmm, because we've made it pretty dang far.
Yeah,
like,
that's actually the change that I want to see happen is that marriage,
the big parties,
is just less of a big deal, you know, because like, you know, marriage is that's two people like thinking it's going to work, but who knows, right? Because there's a lot that you got to sort out together still, probably. And once you starting your financial lives together, which means like you don't have the means. So if instead it was a celebration of your ability to, as a team, you know, get to the point where you manage to figure out how to stay together and like in a happy way, not just because you feel like you should, right? But you stay together, you figure it out, you have a great relationship, and then 10 years later, you've like, because you started off on a nice financial foot because you didn't spend $20,000 on a wedding, now you've got the means now, and now you can have
a big party. So what you're saying is for weddings, the new tradition should be, a few folks get together.
Get the family together.
The couple signs the, you know, the wedding papers, and everybody kind of golf claps, like, you know, mm-hmm. like, good for you, you signed a paper, but like, we'll see where this goes.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
And then after 10 years, it's like, all right, you're onto something here. I think it's time to have a party. And then after 20 years, it's like, wow, you guys are you're doing great. It's time to have a real big party, you mm-hmm. know? And like, that's the point where you have like what is currently the thing that you do at the beginning.
Yep.
You know?
Celebrate the power of your taxable entity.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyways, you know, wedding rant over.
Yeah,
that's all the time we have.
I didn't intend for that to go, but as soon as you brought up I was like, one of my many points of enragement that I then can't not talk about when it comes up, you know.
Yep,
there
just,
we are.
You know, just don't trap yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
No, don't fall into traps. Be your own person. All right. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together, and thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the archives. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.